Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai. There's joy in every journey.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress-them-on-the-third-date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Play ball! It's 30 with Murdy with your host, Sweeney Murdy.
Hi, welcome back, everyone. On this episode, a conversation about the Olympics with former Mets All-Star and Yankees coach Lee Mazzilli. How's that exactly? Well, before the Brooklyn-born and raised Mazzilli embarked on a 14-year Major League career, including a key role with the 1986 World Champion Mets, he was a national champion speed skater. From grade school in the 1960s into his teenage years in the early 70s, Mazzilli won 8 championships at his age levels, and he competed with and against several future Olympians. So we talk about speed skating from his Brooklyn roots through the decision of choosing baseball over a chance to make the Olympics, and some perspective on the Olympic speed skaters we watch every 4 years, including legends of the sport like Bonnie Blair and Eric Heiden. But after we spoke about that sport, we shifted gears to baseball, and that led to a whole other discussion. So stick around for some great stories about Mazzilli's playing days in the 1970s and 80s involving Hall of Fame teammates like Tom Seaver, Willie Mays, and Joe Torre, and of course, his thoughts on the current labor situation and the game of baseball today. Here is my conversation with Lee Mazzilli. Maz, first question I want to ask you, it's pretty simple. How does a kid from Brooklyn get into speed skating?
That's a great question, because to this day, I'm still trying to figure that out. My dad did that with my uncle, I'm going to say probably like in the 40s. They did that when they were younger, in the 40s and 50s. And all of a sudden, you know, my dad just brought me to the skating rink and we skated, and I was with my sister and my brother, and I fell in love with it. I liked it, you know. And then we started to go to different rinks. So, you know, at that time there's very much open skating, not as it is now. So you had a rink in Prospect Park in Brooklyn, which was close to me at home. Mm-hmm. And then they had a rink in right by Chase Stadium was in Flushing. There was a skating rink there. They had one in Yonkers. So there was several rinks that you can go and train for speed skating at that time. And then once I got into it, we would go up into meets. I would skate in Saratoga in the wintertime on a lake, Lake George, Lake Placid. Then you would make the eastern run of the eastern seaboard. You go up to Pittsfield, all down the east coast. So that's really how I got into it. You know, it was a kind of a weekend thing. You know, you train during the week at Prospect Park, and then you would get into events. And I guess I'm looking at, I don't know what age, 7, 8, somewhere around there, 9 when I probably started.
That's when you did your first competitive meets, when you were 7 or 8?
I believe so. Yeah. Yeah. I don't. Yeah. I'm going to say in that range. And then it was, then you belong to a club, a skating club, because obviously back in, I'm going to say what? So if you know, looking in the 60s that I was doing this, started, there were a lot more events, a lot more clubs, and it was big. You know, it was a big, I don't want to say like league, but a big following in skating. There was a lot of speed skating back then.
So you were, what events did you do? I know it differs as you get older, the distances change, but were you a sprinter? Were you a distance guy? What were you?
Well, I was a sprinter at the beginning because that's all you did. So it wasn't measured in meters like skating today, like speed skating is done today, like a 500 meter, 1,000 meters. So when you are younger, so let's say when you're 7 and 8, they really didn't have long distances. So you would skate a 110-yard race.
Okay.
And then you would skate a 220-yard race. And the younger you were, probably to 220 was probably the longest event. And then you went up to a 440-yard race, which was like a quarter-mile race. And then you had a three-quarter-mile race. And a mile race, and so on and so forth. So, and then you had an 880 race. So they kind of, you know, brought the young kids up little by little, and every year that, or every group that you went up, they extended the distances of races.
Now, when you're playing baseball, I know when you were a kid, you were a fast runner. Does being a fast runner equate to being a fast speed skater?
Great question. Yes, I believe so. And everyone said that, but I believe that because of the stretching that was involved. And one of the things back then, and like I said, you're going back, I don't know, 40, 50 years ago, you know, yeah, the only really thing that you really did to train, a big thing, obviously the skating part of it, you trained all the time, but was just really stretching, a lot of stretching. And I think stretching at a young age, really helped. You know, I can, you know, one of the things that, you know, when I came up, I could run.
Yeah.
I think skating had something to do with it. Yeah.
What were meets like? Now I'm asking you to go back and think about over 50 years ago, but when you are competing in these meets at 8, 10, 12 years old, what do you remember about the environment of a speed skating?
Cold. You know, you can see the uniforms that they have on now that speed skaters wear, and it wasn't so much aerodynamic as it is now, but you just basically had a pair of like tights on like that and a jersey, a pullover shirt, a nylon, very, very, very thin. So, you know, you'd huddle up in big hoodies and coats and go on the lake, and you wait till your race was coming up, and you whip off that coat, you skate, and you whip it back on. So it was cold, man. People were lined up outside on the lake camping, and you know, having all the hot drinks that you need to stay warm, little fires and things of that. But I could tell you one time, and boy, I wish I could find this. So maybe if someone is ever listening to this. I skated in a national championship in St. Paul, Minnesota. And there's proof of this because it was in the New York Times article. First time I've ever went to a national championship, and it was in St. Paul, Minnesota. I think it was on Lake Como in St. Paul, Minnesota. And it was 52 below zero. That was the 52. So, you know, I was like 11 or 12 years old, and you didn't feel any pain at that time. But till you start reading about it, it's like, God, I was 52. It's 52 below, Sweeney. And so I went up winning the national championship as an 11-year-old, which was just really unheard of because we skated in the East, and most of all the good skaters were in the Midwest. Mm-hmm. So we never had the facilities. But I was on Wide World of Sports.
Wow.
And I believe the announcer was, if I'm not mistaken, was Chris Schenkel.
Sure.
He's the one that did Wide World of Sports, right? And there was a clip that we, you know, back then, you know, you had like three or four or five channels on your TV, and that was it. The Wide World of Sports was a huge event. And I was on that, and I'm trying to find that tape of Wide World of Sports with Chris Schenkel. He did like a quick interview of me at 11 years old. So if anyone's listening and could track that down, boy, I would love to see that, that clip.
What kind of an, listen, I've known you for a long time. What kind of an interview would 11-year-old Lee Mazzilli given on TV?
Oh, that's why I want to see it. You know, I want to hear it again. I have no idea. I would love to know what I said. You know, I really would. I don't remember. I really don't. But I know I did it. I saw it many, many years later. And I said, oh, that's great, and really didn't think anything of it.
Yeah.
And now that you get older, you say, boy, I would love to see that tape. So I'm going to try to track it down somehow.
Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai. There's joy in every journey.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
And you were winning multiple national championships for your age groups, right?
Yeah, I won a lot of nationals. I won like around seven, eight or nine U.S. Open championships at that time. So I didn't lose very often. You know,
yeah.
It was something that I really did well, you know, and I moved up, and I towards the end, I skated against older skaters, you know, to get into better competition. And that's how you got better. You skated with people that were better than you were, or you try to compete with them.
I'm curious, like how the baseball mindset and the skating mindset kind of blend together for you, because as you would find out, I'm sure you found this out as a kid too, as a high school kid, that baseball is a humbling game. And you knew that during your professional career, obviously, mm-hmm. well, but even as a high schooler, there were times when, you know, guys would get you out. But, you know, as a speed skater at that age, I mean, you seemed like you were, you know, it was hard to think of losing when you're winning all these national championships. So did the mindset of baseball being a humbling game, which you still played very well at that age, and having this other sport that you were pretty dominant in, did they conflict at all for you?
No, I think, you know, when you're an athlete, young or old, and it's something that we have that's in our DNA, and we have this competitiveness in us that we just don't lose. And it's very hard to explain that. So even now, like if I, you know, I'm going to be 66, and I'm going to be 60. I'm in my 60s right now, and I feel in my mind, because all the years that I played, is that I feel like I still can go up there right now and get a guy in from second base. Really do right now at my age. But in reality, I know I can't. You know I can't. Everyone knows I can't. But for us as athletes, we feel in our mind we can do it. Now, we know we can't physically do it, but I don't know how to describe that. You know, you could laugh and say, you can't do it. But there's some kind of like, there's something in you like saying, yeah, I can. I think I can. And, you know, and I guess what you're trying to talk yourself into is like, give me a shot, man. You know, give me a shot. Let me see if I can, you know. So it's like a zillion to one that you can't. but you just think that you can. And that's the, I guess, competitive edge as athletes that you never want to lose, that you won't always want to have. And you could say this about a football player or a basketball player or whoever it may be, tennis. I'm sure that they feel that they go on the court or the ice and do that one last heroic thing, you know. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a good quality or to have, a good trait to have as an athlete. You don't want to lose that, you know. You always think you have one last one in you.
Right.
You can be on your dying bed, you know. You got like 3 minutes to live, and you're going to say, yeah, give me another shot.
Listen, I'm sure you might be able to get into the under 70 speed skating event somewhere and probably take it in the middle, no?
No, that's no fun. Well, under 70. That's good. All right, I want to go to the other 61, and I'll be ready.
The two most famous American speed skaters are Bonnie Blair and Eric Heiden, and you have a little history with both of them, right?
Yes, I do. And Bonnie Blair and her family, you know, they grew up right not too far from where you live. They're in South Salem or somewhere there. So we skated against them as kids. I skated against Bonnie Blair's brother. Mm-hmm. Robbie Blair in my age group, and she had a whole family, her and her sister, and you know, Bonnie was she's a few years younger than I, so she really didn't, you know, kind of skate with us, but you know, when I went to baseball, she went to kept skating, and her family and her just turned out to be great skaters for the sport, medalist in a couple of Olympic games, and she coached. So I got a chance to, I did a kind of a fundraiser that I was going to do for speed skating last year for the Olympics this year. And Bonnie and I got on a Zoom called Raise Money. And on the phone call before, and I haven't spoken to her in, it's got to be 30 years maybe, you know. I mean, I saw her when I was playing, maybe when I was with at Wrigley Field or something, but I haven't spoken to her in 30 some odd years. And Sweeney, when I tell you, it was like we didn't miss a beat, and we spoke last week, and it was 30 years, and we spoke for about an hour and a half, just about so much of skating and old times and family. That was kind of cool. So, and then Eric Heiden, God bless him. What an athlete. I think I mentioned this to you before, that what he has accomplished in Winter Olympics is totally, people just don't realize, because of the exposure is not as big as, let's say, a track and field event or things of that nature. But what he accomplished in Lake Placid will never be done again. He won every single event in speed skating, and that's equivalent to any
distances.
Yeah, the sprint was probably his hardest one, to win a 500 meter, but he was so good, you know, in 1500, 1000. So he won everything from the sprint to like winning a marathon in track and field. And yeah, it's just unheard of. You know, if you could just watch what he did and say, well, he's the fastest human being in the world in track and field. Oh, by the way, he's going to run the marathon on the last day of the Olympics. And then he wins a gold medal there too as well.
Yeah.
And then everything in between. It's just mind boggling what he did, you know? So, and he was a little younger than I was when we were skating. So he really didn't skate with me one-on-one. And I never got really a chance to see him until I was, you know, already out playing ball and stuff like that, to really watch what he did in 1980. Because I think it was 80, right? In Lake Placid.
Yeah. And that's what I was going to ask you. I mean, you're right. It's like watching Usain Bolt win the, you know, set a world record in the 100 and then win the mile or the marathon or something like that. That's how impressive a feat it was. But he's winning these gold medals at Lake Placid in February 1980. You had left your speed skating career behind, and you were in a pretty good place. I mean, you made the All-Star game in 1979. You're hitting a home run in the All-Star game in 79. And then a few months later, you're watching Eric Heiden do his thing on you know, in your former event. What was that like at that stage, knowing that you had, you know, you had chosen a path and you were successful on that path, and you were watching this other guy do what he was doing?
Yeah. because as a fan, you know, you're watching on TV, you're screaming, you're rooting, you know what I'm saying? Because you're not that far removed. So it is almost like, I don't know, if it's 6 degrees of separation, you had that connection, you know, and with the Blaz and the other skaters. And so, you know, you felt like, you know, you're successful in one sport and they're successful in another sport. And it's just kind of neat that how they both gelled together and knowing them. So when I was watching it, I was totally amazed. I mean, I didn't know he was going to be able to get five. You know, I thought his toughest event was going to be the 500 sprint, you know, to win that. And the other ones were going to be pretty much a lock. And it's just a fan, like you go to the stadium and cheer and yell. And that's what I was doing. So that was kind of neat.
All right, so let's backtrack a little bit, because you had an opportunity, because you're, you know, pretty highly ranked nationally, winning championships in your age groups as a teenager. You get to 1971, and you were actually invited to the training facility to train for a possible Olympic bid in 72.
Yes, we had the Olympics were in Sapporo, Japan, 1972. So at that time, I was really into baseball. I started to get my niche. So So I was 16, about 17. I was getting followed. That summer was a big summer for me for baseball. And back then, you know, you had all your scouts were coming out, and all these clubs were coming out to see you. So you were known amongst the baseball circle of someone that was going to be drafted. And I had to make a decision. Because if I would have went to the Air Force Academy at that time where it was being held in Colorado, then I missed the whole baseball season, the summer season. And that was the big summer season to set up for your draft the following year. And you had to make a decision. You know, at that time, you could not be a professional and then have amateur status. So the question is, what do I want to do? Do I want to go, which I did want to go to the Olympics, or do I want to play baseball and have these scouts watching me? And it was a hard decision, but it was an easy decision, if that makes sense. You know, I love baseball. I mean, I love skating. I love what I did. I really wanted to try to go to the Olympic Games. And then I'm saying I want to play baseball. And you know that old saying, you know, you never forget your first love as your girlfriend when you're growing up. You always got your first love, you know, who you dated. And that was baseball. It was my first love. I had to go back to my first love. So I made that decision. And you know what? I never looked back for a second. Not for a second. I said, oh, it's baseball. It's what I want to do. Today, I look back all the time. And, you know, in the last few years, and then you get a chance to watch the Olympics. And I always look back and I say, you know, now the only thing I regret is I really wish I had a chance to make the Olympic team. Or, boy, if you made the Olympic team, how cool would it be to say that you are an Olympian, an Olympian athlete to represent the United States? How cool is that, you know? So that's the thing that I kind of wish I was able to do both. But like I said, at that day and age, you were not allowed to be a professional and amateur. Nowadays, everyone is a professional in the Olympics.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Hey, Rob Bradford here. I have set out on a mission with my good friends at FanDuel to prove what I have known for some time. Baseball isn't boring. Now I have a daily podcast to prove it with some of the most notable people in the baseball world screaming baseball isn't boring from the mountaintops, or at least agreeing to come on our show. Players, managers, GMs, and yes, even the commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred. It has been a constant wave of baseball's most powerful voices. So join the revolution. Subscribe and soak in Baseball Isn't Boring. Listen on your Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. You'll be glad you did.
You know, I'm curious, though, you say you didn't have any regrets back then, the next Olympics in 76, it's February 1976, and you're about to report to spring training after, now in 75, you were in A-ball. So it's not like you had reached the major leagues yet. You would later in 76, but spring training in 76, right before spring training in 76, you haven't made it out of A-ball. And there's a couple of guys who won medals on, for Team USA that are right around your age group. And you probably competed against at some point in your life. Dan Immerfall won a bronze medal in the 500. He's nine months younger than you. And Peter Muller won a gold in the 1,000 meter. He's a year older than you. So do you remember these guys winning medals?
Yeah. And
thinking about, like, you know, hey, I was with them. I was one of them.
Yes. Absolutely. And also, you know, cheering them on as well, you know, pulling for them. But it really didn't matter. Even being in A-ball, it didn't matter because I was still a professional athlete. So there was nothing that I could say, oh, look, you know what? Let me take the summer off, or let me see if I could train and go back. That was out. So that was out the window. But yeah. And I think anytime you skate or compete with your fellow skaters or you just your peers or whatever, and you see them do well in different sports, I don't know. I'm one of those individuals that cheer for them and want them to do well and excel. I don't think most athletes, you know, want players to fail or anything of that nature. So I looked at it as, oh, this is great. One of us is doing it.
All right. So here's my key question for you. Dan Immerfall won a bronze medal in the 500 meter, a sprint, with a time of 39.54 seconds. The gold medal winner from the USSR was 39.17. Could 21-year-old Lee Mazzilli have?
Yes. Oh, yeah. I think I would have been in that time range. But, you know, because I was, when I started, it was called Olympic style skating. That was on the oval track, outdoor track. But most of the skating when I was indoors, short track. And that was my specialty. I love short track racing because of, you know, being fast, but being able to maneuver and they used to have blocks up there that you had to skate around. So I was able to be a guy that would be daring on the ice, you know, take chances and stuff like that. So that was my thing, indoor skating. But back then, they didn't have short track skating in the Olympics. And that was my thing, more so than the Olympic style skating of being outside on the 400 meter track. I would have loved to have been able to gone back and been in short track skating, because that was my niche, short track skating. And as you can see it on TV now, it is very, very exciting, you know?
Yeah.
Because, you know, when it's just one slip and you're done. Or one missed turn, you know, and I mean, it's just so right on. And that was my thing. And I would have loved to have done that. And they got mass skating now, and they got team relay skating. They didn't have any of that.
Yeah, I was going to say, the team relay is what I was going to ask you about. Like, that looks like just mass chaos on these short tracks.
Yeah, absolutely. That's when the very first time I saw that, I went, what the hell is going on here? I said, they're not allowed to be on the inside of that track, you know, because on the inside, kind of like the warm-up area and stuff, and you see skaters. And then I watched it for a while, and I said, man, that's neat, man. I said, that's kind of cool. So, I wish they would have had that back then, yeah. Yeah, we had some events where, you know, back, you know, when I was younger, you know, we skated at, you know, we had some events at Madison Square Garden and things like that, some big events, and then I would travel to St. Louis, you know, skate St. Louis with a blues play. I remember as a kid skating the Nationals there. And I said, oh, man, the St. Louis Blues play on the same ice, you know, things like that. Because you just, you know, you kind of envision all these great athletes and stuff.
All right. So we talked a little bit about, like, just being fast in one sport and another, the similarity there. What else was there anything else that you learned as a kid who competed at high levels in speed skating that translated and helped you as your baseball career took off?
Oh, the competition was, it's always mono, you know, it's one against one and skating. You feel like, you know, Well, let me differentiate this. You know, in Olympic style skating, it's more time than one on one. Okay, so you're racing against the clock now.
Yeah.
Back when I played, it was more of a mass skating. So if we had a final, we didn't race against time. We, you know, we might have 7, 8, as high as 10 people in a final, but. And then you were skating against each other. So it was more of a kind of, you know, lay back, let someone else take the lead. It was like horse racing almost, you know. Okay. You lay in a pack and you watch who, you knew who was good. You knew the ones you didn't have to worry about that were not very good skaters. So you kind of concentrated on beating that one person all the time. So that was different. And so it was kind of learning, you know, your moves, when you wanted to go. I look at that as the same thing as, you know, playing baseball. It's like, you know, it's you against the pitcher all the time. But it was different because you just really focused on the ones that you needed to beat. And that was it. You know, so time wasn't really a major concern of what you skated. I remember skating in one event that we used to have what was called a turkey trot. It was held on Thanksgiving morning, and okay. I think it was like a 6 or 10 mile race. I forget what it was, which was a longer turkey. It was like the one event a year, like, you know, 10 miles, man. Are you kidding me? Over and over in a circle. So I, you know, and I really never skated that. And then you know, one year I went into that, and because. A fellow skater of mine was in on this, and it was always our competition. And so was skating in this event. I forget, it was either a 6 or 10 mile race. It was one of those two. And the guy that I wanted to beat was the one that we competed against. And there was someone else that took off on a race. And when I say if it was a 6 mile race, and it was a shorter track than a 440 and a bigger than a short track. So I'm just guessing that it was, let's say, and it was like 80 laps or something like that, okay. Or 90 or 100 laps. That's what it took, you know, okay. to complete the event. But anyway, this one skater took off on us, and he wasn't a threat, but he took off like when there was like 4 miles to go, and no one's even bothered saying, "Well, he's going to be dead in like, you know, another mile or two. He's going to burn out. He's not going anywhere." And the son of a gun held on the whole way, and he wound up winning because I lost sight of him.
Wow!
But I beat the guy that I needed to beat, and I was happy with that. So, but that was kind of a cool event, man. They had that every year in Brooklyn. It was at Prospect Park. It was called the Turkey Trot of Thanksgiving morning. So keep your eye on the prize all the time.
You mentioned, I mean, obviously, listen, November, and whether it's in Brooklyn or upstate New York, you're skating in cold conditions. You talked about St. Paul, it's minus 50. When you're playing, I don't know, like an April game at Wrigley Field or at Shea Stadium, do you feel cold, or are you sitting there thinking, man, I've been in worse?
No, I feel cold. It's nothing worse than being playing in the outfield in Wrigley Field when it's like, you know, -2 degrees with the wind chill, and you're, you know, it's just like, oh man, let me get through this game without getting hurt, and maybe tomorrow I'll do well. Now I'll bunt a couple times today so I don't hurt my hands, but playing in cold weather, you know, cold weather was you got through that, but it was the cold, it was the wind that always got to me, you know, in baseball. Now, playing at Candlestick Park was just a tough, tough stadium to play in. You know, God bless Willie Mays, man, and what he did in his career. There's no doubt that if he didn't play at Candlestick Park, he would have 800 home runs, without a doubt. Without a doubt.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, just – you've been to Candlestick Park, right?
No, I never had the pleasure. No.
Oh, really? Well, yeah. I would say pleasure. I don't know if it was a pleasure. But it was just it was so compelling to get out there because there were so many – factors of Candlestick that were against you, like other than playing, like the clubhouse back then was in right field underneath the stands. Okay. So once you came out of the clubhouse in Candlestick and you walked to the third base side, that's where your dugout was. It was a tiny little dugout. I don't even know if it had a bathroom. Yeah, it had a little tiny little bathroom. and it was a small dugout. And once you came out, you were stuck. Like, you were stuck for nine. Like, you couldn't go anywhere to get loose, get throw. You were there. And if you had to go back into the clubhouse for anything, which no one ever did because you didn't want to say, oh, where's he going? You know, you didn't want to say anything.
He's going to
get warm. You didn't want to say anything, we're leaving the field. Yeah. Or he's going to get something to eat or whatever. You had to walk across the whole field into the right field corner. So, I mean, it was just everything was against you, man. And you just, as soon as you went to that park, it was like, oh, man, you know. And because you always came, back then, they used to make the West Coast swing.
Like twice a year, you would make all the West Coast stops.
Yeah, the West Coast twice a year and the East Coast three times a year. But you would make the West Coast swing. So let's say the Mets started out in San Diego, and then the Phillies would be in Frisco and Montreal, you know, could be in L.A. or whatever. And you hit those three teams. So we would hit each club. We would hit the Dodgers, the Padres, and the Giants. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you go to San Francisco and you come out of San Diego, which was, you know, that's like God's weather out there. It's just magnificent. And you go to L.A. with 70 and San Diego 80 degrees. And it's just beautiful in July or August. Then you go to San Francisco and it's 50 in the 40s at nighttime in summertime. It's just so brutal. And then the wind, and you play the day games and you couldn't see. And it just fascinates me what Willie Mays did at that stadium. He really did.
Wow. And no comparison to teenage Maz on the speed skating track.
It didn't help me at all there, man. No.
So you mentioned all those times, all those years, you really thought no regrets, but as you watch Eric Heiden on the medal stand, you watch Bonnie Blair in a medal stand, you watch the Olympics every 4 years now and watch the speed skating and see these guys with their national anthems and sitting on the medal stand. I told you the winning times in 1976, and you're telling me without a doubt you could have beaten that.
No, I won't say without a doubt, but I think I'd be right around.
On that medal stand? Can you feel yourself up there when you watch these?
Nah, I don't look at it that way at all. You know, I don't look at it that. I think that if I would have continued, I would have liked my chances. I think I would have competed very well. Mm-hmm. Because you know the only I kind of quit skating at a younger age, you know, so I didn't even reach my peak yet, to be honest with you.
Yeah, right.
In the training side, so I feel like I would have been in that situation, but I don't looking at the medal stands even now, thinking or regret that at all. Nah, that doesn't even enter my mind. No.
All right, so I got one more for you. Your big league career began in 1976, which is right around the time free agency was taking off. You sat in many meetings during your playing career with Marvin Miller and then with Spear. So as you see the state of baseball where we are, we're in early February, and there's not an end in sight to a work stoppage here. As a guy who's kind of been through those wars from very early on, what are your thoughts on what's happening?
Well, you know, well, one, it's sad, but you know, I'm trying to figure out what this war is about. You know, I knew what it was back when I was playing. I knew what we struck for and what Marvin did. I don't know what they're doing now. I really don't. You know, what are they looking to? What's their priority? I looked at some of the stuff where we looked at 1976, 77, and the minimum salary. And the minimum salary was $16,000 a year, you know. So if they're arguing they want $500,000 or $600,000 or $700,000, that's great. You know what I'm saying? I looked at 60. I knew that we were fighting for really rights because we were overwhelmed by ownership back in the 70s and 80s. You know, they had the upper hand. There's no doubt. You knew that. You were around.
Yeah.
With the reserve clause and free agency. So players didn't have much. Players have a lot today. Now, that being said, I'm not saying the players are not looking to get things that they need. Yes. But it seems like there's no give and take at all. I know the means that we went to with Marvin and stuff, you know, there's something to say, hey, we're okay with this. So, you know, let's fight this, you know, let's fight this another day type thing. And you gave in. I don't know what they're doing. It seems like no side is budget. Do you agree or not? And you're in this as well.
Well, yeah, nobody's moving. I mean, I see the sides. I mean, I'm a worker. I'm not an owner. I'm a member of a union. So I understand, you know, I'm a member of a union that, you know, while I've been in it, has never had to strike or been locked out. So I don't know that feeling.
Yeah.
But I understand.
It's not fun.
I understand the side of where earnings are being restricted, sometimes artificially, but all within the rules. And while revenues are growing, the players feel like they need to be taken care of better. So
right.
I understand the player's side of it very well.
Okay. So with that being said, what you just said, and I think you said that well, is like the revenues are really growing in TV package from ownership side or whatever.
Yeah.
And the players want some of that is what you're saying, or a piece of it or whatever they want. So why isn't that like let's share the wealth type that, you know,
yeah, sure.
Let's share something.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So, you know, I've been on both sides of it. I've seen it. Just hopefully that there's a resolution that could get the game back. I think the game needs to change. I think fans are getting a little, I don't know. I think the fans miss the old style of game. I think they want to change it to a lot of things that don't need to be changed. I think, you know, I don't know. The game's different nowadays, but it's still the greatest game in the world. And you got to get them on the field. And you got to play. And you got to get the fans back. And you know, you want to see all the people. I mean, get back to playing. I don't know. You better get back to playing, otherwise you won't have nothing to do, Sweeney.
That's it. I'm gonna have to find more Olympic events to talk about and things like that.
That's the only one I have, my man. So let me ask you that question. Do you think there's going to be a resolution soon, or do you think that they're going to go into April or something to that nature?
I think the closer you get to March 1st, when then it becomes a real issue of potentially missing games, I think that's the deadline that hastens progress here. I don't think that anyone is really looking at the start of spring training as a deadline that needs to be
no.
met. They're going to look at the idea of missing regular season games. And we're going to find, I think the downside is, let's say for argument's sake that we get an agreement that happens early enough that there are no regular season games missed, but you still miss some spring training. Now, I know from talking to position players like you that, you know, you don't need more than 3 or 4 weeks to get ready. It's already too long, but the pitchers right. have an issue, and the injury situations that we've seen the last few years, a lot of it, even just the last 2 years, you had a weird and shorter spring in 2020. And that led to some injury issues. The shortened season led to some problems in 2021 from a stamina and performance standpoint in some people. I think the more you flirt with messing up spring training this year, the more issues you're going to have physically with players as the season goes along. And I think that's a real danger.
Well, I think they probably won't have 162 games. And I think the owners are okay with that in a way. I mean, yeah. I don't think there's a rush to get games back in April. You know, whether it be 5 games or something, 10 games, whatever. But I don't know if I'm buying that point of guys getting hurt
okay.
as much. And here's my reasoning for that, thinking on that. It is so much of a 12-month year sport right now than it's ever been.
Sure.
These players now are bigger, stronger, faster. Their conditioning is unbelievable. They do it for 12 months. I mean, it may take them, I don't know, a few weeks off. So the constant working out and being in shape was not like it was 10, 20, 30 years ago. That I could tell you right now.
Good
so you should be coming into camp almost to where you're ready to play a game. Other than the physical part of getting your arm in shape and getting your legs in shape, if you're not running and doing things basic-wise outdoors, you should be ready to go. You really should. So I don't think a player should worry about that as much. You know, I know players do not want to play 30 games in spring training, so they don't need the 30 games. I'll tell you a little story real quick. When I first – this is how much the game has evolved and changed. That when I first signed – and people in New York will get this. I would go down to spring training, and I would go down and I would take the day before spring training, I take a flight out of LaGuardia. I take Eastern Airlines. Remember the old Eastern Airlines flight? Yeah. Right? I take like a 9 o'clock flight out. I get into St. Petersburg that night. I go to the hotel, wake up, and go to spring training the next morning, start spring training the next day. I get down a day before. You know, so in the 70s, if you went down to Florida or spring training, let's say you went down there a week early or 4 or 5 days early, the guys on the team say, what are you doing? How come you came down so early? Like, what are you doing? Because there were no facilities for you to go to work out. So if I went to spring training that day and let's say and I wanted to go to the field, then no one had bats or balls out there. There was no coach working with you. To get ready. I mean, there were no facilities to work out, so you never went down early. So it was just so much. I remember, you know, going to spring training with Seaver and Kuzman guys, and they would do the same thing. You know, you went to spring training to get in shape. That was the mindset. That not that it was wrong or you should have been early. That's not. It wasn't available for anyone. You know. So I couldn't go to camp and say, okay, is there a cage set up? What cage? We don't have a cage. Can I go here? No, you see the beach, you can go right on the beach. You know, that's what they told you. So completely different. Nowadays, you see the size of these kids coming in, and they're just built like monsters. They work so hard. They got a diet that's unbelievable. How they're fed, they're, you know, Jerry Grody always used to say, "Yeah, I'm going to get me a cheeseburger and then a Diet Coke, so I stay on my diet." That's what he say. So, and that was that was your nutrition. So it's completely different now. So I don't know if players are not ready to go now because of the competition and because of the money what is available to make.
Exactly,
and that's their own fault.
What I was just going to say is that when you're looking at $16,000 a year as a major league minimum, you know, your outlook on what you do in the offseason is a little bit different probably.
Oh, yeah. Well, hey, sweetie, when I was in my leagues, I had to work in the wintertime.
Yeah. What was your job? What did you do in the winter?
Well, I worked at JFK Airport. I drove the Caterpillar trucks around, you know, with the luggage.
Uh-huh.
So if you had luggage, then I probably lost it on you. trucks. I worked in a department store, you know. Whatever I could do, work with some friends just to make extra money at that time. Because, you know, back then, you know, minor leaguers were, I took home $395 a month in the minor leagues my first year. $395.
And did you ever pick up a bat from the end of the minor league season until the first day of spring training?
Yes, yes. You know what you did? You would go into the old gymnasium in high school. You know, the old gyms?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes they would have a cage in there. Some high schools would back then. I was telling my son, you know, when I first started in the minor leagues, that we lived in an apartment downstairs in the building. There was a garage, and they parked cars downstairs in the garage. And I would go downstairs in the garage and throw against the wall with all these cars coming. Every time the door went open, a car come in, I had to stop throwing, you know. And that's what I did. And that's because that's all you had. I mean, we would have killed to find places to have now. And now it's so readily available, which is great. That's not a bad thing. It's just I kind of look back at what I had to do to get ready and say, that's kind of neat, man. This is what we did. But look what you have now, what's available. So there's no reason for a player not to be ready to go now because everything's available. They really want you. You know, there's so many facilities down here that in Florida that I see that these kids are down here that are 15 years old or younger. You know, mm-hmm. They come down and train for a month for their high school season or Sandlot team. So it's really grown exponentially to this point. Of being ready in baseball, which is a good thing. It's not a bad thing, man. You look back and say, oh man, I wish I had a T, man. I couldn't get a T, you know, because most of our coaches were, and God bless them, man. I was so lucky. I had coaches that came up that I loved them to death. They were like my uncles, but they're older coaches, you know, they'd be smoking cigarettes behind the batting cage, and you know, it's, hey, can I go hit? Hit, yeah, you already took five swings. Don't worry about it. You don't need any more. But I need more. Ah, you're good. Don't worry. See you tomorrow. And then you have cigarettes behind the cage, man. Oh, it was great, man. But they were like uncles to you, man. You know, like when I came up, I don't know if you remember Phil Cavaretta. Yeah. Phil Cavaretta was the hitting coach for the Mets. You know, he was MVP for the Cubs in 1945. Yeah. I loved him to death. Then we had Rube Walker to play for the Brooklyn Dodgers, the pitching coach. Joe had him as the pitching coach, and Joe Pignatano. And they were just, you know, they were characters. They knew baseball. You talk about baseball all the time. You learned a lot from them. But, you know, just to get anything extra, good luck, man. Good luck, man. But hey, I can tell you that, you know, I was lucky. When I came up in 76, I had guys that really taught me baseball. I had Tom Seaver, Jerry Kuzman, Joe Torre, Buddy Harrelson. You know, they were – I learned a lot of hitting from Tom Seaver. I learned a lot about hitting from Jerry Kuzman. You know, they would tell you, they would talk to you about how they would set up hitters and how they pitch guys. And that's stuff that I didn't know or we didn't know coming out of the minor leagues. Mm-hmm. And it was just an education to listen to, you know, one of the greatest pitchers of all time tell you what he looks for, how he wants to set up hitters. And I just don't think they do enough of that today. But, you know, and then I had Joe, who was my teammate. He's the one that took me under his wing and taught me about the game and what big league life was and all that nature. And that's something that you can never, ever get back. I mean, I just remember conversations to this day that you know, we had. And Jerry Kuzman, I love Jerry Kuzman to death, man. He's like one of my all-time favorite teammates, you know.
You told me this, Maz. Didn't Joe Torre just come say, when you got called up, here, come sit next to me?
Yeah. He said, you stay with me. And he took me under his wing, and he says, you just stick with me, and, you know, 45 years later, we still are, you know, so that's special, you know. And Jerry Kuzman is, Jerry, like, if you didn't really take a guy out or roll block him at second base, you know, Kuzman would come over and say, hey, you got to take him out, you know, or, you know, like, not getting mad at you, but he's going to tell you, you got to take him out. Like, I learned how to take guys out at second base, you know, listening to and watching these guys, and, you know, you learn how to roll block it, and, you know, that's like, people don't even know what that means anymore, roll blocking. Yeah. You know, and Jerry Kuzman, if someone pitched you a tighter in and Kuzman was pitching, he'd come over to you on the bench and Kuzman would say, hey, you want me to get him for you? I mean, it was great, man. That's what he would say, you know? Like, if you got brushed back, he'd say, hey, you want me to get him for you? You know, things of that nature are priceless, you know, but it just doesn't happen nowadays, you know? So I was fortunate enough to be around a lot of good baseball people. And that's how you learn the game. You really learn the game. You know, I sit down, you know, Bobby Valentine and I are like brothers, man. We started out and we were roommates together. That relationship, how it evolved over the years, has meant a lot to me. So I was always around the good baseball people and good minds of just listening and being in conversation. And I'm going to tell you something, and I don't want to blow any smoke up you, but you know, credit to you is you do that, you know, and I noticed that because I remember a couple of times when we were in hotel bars after games and stuff, you'd always come over to me and talk baseball and ask questions. And I didn't forget that, you know, when you first started following the Yankees. Am I correct on that?
Yeah. 2001, that was your second year as a coach. And I mean, you were nice enough to me when we had done shows, you know, take people behind the curtain a little bit. Howie Rose was broadcasting shows and I was his producer at Lee Mazzilli's Sports Cafe on the West Side in the mid 1990s. So
but even when you're on a beat,
you didn't forget that. Let me throw it right back to you. You didn't forget that I was this kid who'd worked his way up the chain. And when I started covering the Yankees, I think you were the only person in the room that I knew that I had a relationship. Yeah. And you you were nice to me there too.
Well, not being nice. I'm saying is, it was like you were inquisitive. You asked questions. You want to know about certain things. Yeah. And, you know, so that's how you learn. I was with a friend, who I'll leave nameless, and I was at Joe Torre's golf tournament, and I was sitting down with Joe and Tony La Russa and myself, and we're having breakfast for about a half hour or so, just talking, you know, about stuff, just talking baseball, back and forth. And as we left breakfast and we got up and we were walking to go play golf, I said to my friend, I said, "And that's how you learn about baseball." You know what I'm saying?
That's how you learn.
That's all. You listen, you talk, you know, you agree, you disagree, you know, but, you know, that's the problem I see nowadays in the game from the analytics side of it. Which drives me crazy is that it's not analytics, it's not bad, or the metrics, but they're not willing to give and take. And, you know, like they give you a number and say, you know, this is gospel, and it's not gospel, man. Yeah. It's not. And you play this game, you know, so you got to be willing to say, I agree there. But I also, what do you think about this? And they're not open enough to listen to what you're saying. And that's the wrong. That's wrong. I think that hurts the game, you know. You know, you very well may say something to me, and you're not a player, but you've been around the game long enough, and you might mention something to me, and I might say, "Ooh, that's interesting." or I might say, "Sweeney, you don't know what you're talking about."
But that's okay. And that's how I learned, by asking you, is this good or is this not worth
it? Yes. Exactly. And that's my point. And from the analytics side of it, it's almost like we're right and you're wrong.
Yeah.
And that's so, that's just not good. It's just not good for the overall game. You have to listen to people, and people have ideas that are so far-fetched, and then some of them are right on target, and you just don't know everything, you know? And you know, when we were coaching with the Yankees, and you won 4 world championships with Joe and Fred Zimmer and Mel and Willie and all of us, you know, we'd sit down, we'd talk, and we'd talk on a bench about strategies and about plays and what do you think here? What do you want to use here? And it's like, you know, some things were said, you know, Zim, God rest his soul, will come up with some ideas that like Joe would like roll his eyes, like, really? And like, I look at Joe and, you know, in a good way, and then like 20 seconds later, he'd say something else, and was like, "Bing, let's do it." Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Or I don't know. Well, hey, you're the manager; you got to make the call. But here it is. You lay it out. But it was in a good way, not a bad way, and no one's feelings got hurt. It wasn't that you were right or wrong; just you threw it out on the table. And you know, as a manager, you got to be able to decipher what's good and what's bad. You know, I learned that too as well, you know, coaching or managing, you know, all the great ones, they're all willing to take a risk. Tony La Russa would say that, Jim Leland I played for, the good managers are willing to take a risk. And when that fails or doesn't work out, they're willing to answer to that risk. And that's the sign of a good manager, because if you do everything one way by paper, then you're in a mediocre range of never being second guessed the question, that you never peek out. You know, you got to be willing to take it, and guess what, it doesn't work out all the time, and that's okay. You know,
nice,
I mean it's okay. It's just, no, I don't think any coach that I've been around or manager ever, or you know, when you're teaching a player or telling a player, all across baseball, I don't think there's any coach or manager ever tells a player to do something or try something knowing that he's going to fail or wants him to fail. You know, I think we're all trying to do this from the goodness of our heart, to think that we're telling them the right thing. We think it's the right thing, but they may not be able to execute that.
Yeah.
But you're not telling them to do this to fail on purpose. No coach would do that. No, I've never come across that.
And the other side of it, Maz, I've used this line before, but I have never actually credited with you. I've always kind of held your anonymity to this, but since I have you here, I'm gonna credit it to you and tell you that I've used it. It's, you know, there are 50,000 people in the seats every night who pretty much know when to bunt or when to take out a pitcher. It's about dealing with the people and the personalities. That's what gets you through a season and with a team.
Oh, no question. But here's the problem. You don't bunt and you don't hit run anymore. So 50,000 people don't know what they're doing. Right. But, you know, I learned this from Willie Mays, being around Willie Mays. And I learned this, and I teach this to this day about base running. And we talk about base running, how great a base runner that Willie was and how daring he was and what he did. And, you know, we were talking about things like coaches and what they do. And he goes, Willie in his high-pitched voice, I don't need no coach. You know, I love Willie to death. You know, we're talking about base running and stuff. And I hold this to this day is the edge that a player wants. We always want that little edge. Somehow we have to find that edge. And when he would talk about base running, he would say, well, we're going to go first to third on a base hit to left field, right? Or we're going to tag up on a certain ball in a corner that's a short fly. And they give you all these things that could happen in the middle of a game. And I said, well, how do you do that? He'd say this. Well, when he'd score from first to home, he'd always say, you know why I can do this? I said, well, how can you do that? He says, you know why I can do it? Because I'm the only one in this stadium that knows what I'm going to do. Not the people, not my third base coach, not my first base coach, not my manager. I'm the only one that knows what I'm going to do next. He said, because the coach might be waving me in, but he doesn't know that my legs are hurting me. I know I can't score.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm not going to do that. Or coach doesn't know. Third base guy doesn't know, man, that I feel good, man. My legs are light or whatever he tried to imply. And you sat back and you said, yeah, that's it. Huh. So out of 50,000 people, he's only one guy that knows what's going on or what he's going to do next.
Yeah.
So I learned that from him as a base runner, the element of surprise. He always said the element of surprise, you know, he's great. He's just, I really wish I got to see him play, obviously, you know, and stuff, but I wish I would have gotten to see him play in the 50s, you know.
Sure.
When he came up, oh man! Well, watch Mickey Mantle play. You know, I miss that. Those are the things that you regret in baseball, that you didn't see those plays play at their prime. You know, I'm not too sure Mickey Mantle ever played in his prime after his first year. He could have been the greatest thing ever. You know, after he blew his knee out, you ever see a clip of him not limping or hurting?
Not after 1951. No.
Yeah, so that was like his first year when in the World Series, he blew his knee out. So just think how great he would have been watching him in his prime, you know. And Hank Aaron, I would have loved to see Hank Aaron. You know, you wish you would have gotten to see those in their prime, but you got to see him on TV. You know, they're pretty good, and you got to hear the stories from the other players, which is even better. You know, I remember the story. I think I don't know who told me this, but when they had the baseball writers' dinner. And they were on Mickey Mantle, Willie Mays, and Duke Snider at the dinner. And the famous quote from Mickey Mantle was, Willie, Duke, and I always knew you were a better center fielder. Something to that effect. I'm trying to paraphrase what he said. Mm-hmm. And can you imagine that being there? I remember the 76 game, I think 77, Old Timers Day at Shea Stadium. I was playing center field. And who comes out of the gates? You saw that picture, right?
Yeah, you were that there. That day.
Yeah, we played. And there's Willie Mays, Mickey Mantle, Duke Snider, Joe D.
Yeah.
Can you imagine? Can you imagine those four walking out, and you're going out to that field and playing?
Yeah.
I better not ruin this position, guys. But that's like hollow ground, man.
You didn't want to drop any balls that day, did you?
No. And they came out. That's hollow ground. Are you kidding, man? They should have took that patch of grass. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And just dug it up, man. That's like the holy grail of center fielders, man. It's those four guys walking out together. That's like, I look at that picture. Have you seen that picture, right?
Yes, very famous.
And it's like, And all of a sudden, you just start thinking about these great players, man. It's like, wow, look at this, man. What he did. What it's just that's one of the greatest pictures. That's one of my favorite pictures to see. I have it somewhere. I don't know where, but I have it somewhere. You know what the best part about that is? That they were so interested in you and talk to you. And they're just like, you know, it's like you talking to Edward R. Murrow, I guess. I don't know.
It's something, you know, like what I'm saying? That. Sure, yeah. It's
something like that, you know?
Yeah. But, how about Vin Scully, Harry Callis? Yeah. These are my, you know, if I'm sitting in a press box and Vin Scully, Harry Callis, and, you know, whoever else you want to name, walk
in. Howard Cosell.
Yeah, walk in there. That's the same picture.
Yeah. Yes. Oh, no doubt. You know, you get the chance to hear Vin Scully now, and it's just, he's like, you listen to his voice, and it's just like tranquility. It's just like, oh, man, it's so relaxing hearing him. It's just like you can almost nod off in a good way. Like
soundtrack of summer, right? Work. You know,
oh, it's man, it's just great, you know. Hey, and the Mets had some good ones, you know, with Kiner and Murphy and Lindsey Nelson. And
Yeah,
you know. When I was young, I got a chance to talk to Lindsey about Notre Dame football, what he did. And, you know, Bob Murphy was just Murph, and he was great. And Ralph would tell you the story. You know, and the Yankees had all the great announcers, too. It's just, those are special times. And those are things that, you know, like you and I could really talk about now that people of our age and stuff can remember that, which is kind of cool.
Well, we'll hopefully we get a chance to share stories like this at a ballpark again sometime later this
season. Yeah, we will, because you can't ruin a great game. You could give it a black eye here and there and there and there, but baseball come up fighting again, man. We'll come back fighting, you know.
My thanks to Lee Mazzilli, who, as you heard in the course of the conversation, I first met in 1994 when I was a young producer at WFAN. Later, Mazzilli was a Yankees coach when I began covering the team in 2001. He's a fixture at Yankees Old Timers Day and will quite certainly be a part of the Mets festivities in the coming years. The announcement this week that the Mets will be bringing back that tradition this summer. Also, special thanks to my friend and colleague, Anthony McCarron, who provided almost all my research material with an article he wrote on Mazzilli's speed skating career in the New York Daily News in 2020. Hey, if you're new here, please check out the 30 with Murdy archive at Odyssey and Apple Podcasts. Check out my last conversation with Chris Dickerson, the former Yankees outfielder who's working on efforts to save the planet, among other post-career adventures. You can also go back and hear recent chats with former Mets first baseman Rico Bronya and filmmaker Andrew Bergman. Make sure to subscribe and review and all that jazz. And until next time, I'm Sweeney Murdy. Thanks for listening.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance, too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Hey, Rob Bradford here. I have set out on a mission with my good friends at FanDuel to prove what I have known for some time. Baseball isn't boring. Now I have a daily podcast to prove it with some of the most notable people in the baseball world screaming baseball isn't boring from the mountaintops, or at least agreeing to come on our show. Players, managers, GMs, and yes, even the commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred. It has been a constant wave of baseball's most powerful voices. So join the revolution. Subscribe and soak in Baseball Isn't Boring. Listen on your Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. You'll be glad you did.